My Bible, anyway. Steve is correct. There's nothing at all negative said about the prophet Daniel in the whole Bible. He was born in Jerusalem and ended up living out the rest of his life in Babylon. And the story of his life, which is woven through the book that he wrote and left for us, is very fascinating. We want to look at his character as much as the rest of the book. Let me read the first chapter. No matter how many times you read a book of the Bible, there's always something more. I'm sure you agree with me. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. The Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the articles of the house of God, which he carried away into the land of Shinar to the house of his God. And he brought the articles into the treasure house of his God. Then the king instructed Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, to bring some of the children of Israel and some of the king's descendants and some of the nobles, young men in whom there was no blemish, but good-looking, gifted in all wisdom, possessing knowledge, and quick to understand, who had ability to serve in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the language and literature of the Chaldeans. The king appointed for them a daily provision of the king's delicacies and of the wine which he drank, and for 3 years of training for them, so that at the end of that time they might serve before the king. Now, from among those of the sons of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. To them the chief of the eunuchs gave names. He gave Daniel the name Belteshazzar, to Hananiah, Shadrach, to Mishael, Meshach, and Azariah, Abednego. But Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested of the chief of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. Now God had brought Daniel into the favor and goodwill of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, "I fear, my lord the king, who has appointed your food and drink. For why should he see your faces looking worse than the young men who are your age? Then you would endanger my head before the king." So Daniel said to the steward, whom the chief of the eunuchs had set over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, "Please test your servants for 10 days, and let them give us vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our countenances be examined before you, and the countenances of the young men who eat the portion of the king's delicacies. And as you see fit, so deal with your servants." So he consented with them in this matter and tested them 10 days. And at the end of 10 days, their countenance appeared better and fatter in flesh than all the young men who ate the portion of the king's delicacies. Thus the steward took away the portion of delicacies and the wine which they were to drink, and gave them vegetables. As for these 4 young men, God gave them knowledge and skill in all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. Now at the end of the days, when the king had said that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. The king interviewed them, and among all none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore they served before the king. And in all matters of wisdom and understanding about which the king examined him, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers who were in his realm. Thus Daniel continued until the first year of King Cyrus. That's just a wonderful little account of the life of this man. Daniel wrote the book. He didn't start writing until he'd been in Babylon 12 years or so. Ezekiel talks about Daniel by mentioning him as one of 3 great men in history. Who are the other 2?
Job
Job, Noah. Noah, Daniel, and Job, Ezekiel said, were as godly a man as you'd find anywhere. And if you had this combinations of these three men, would you have enough righteousness collectively to save the nation? That's the idea. Ezekiel, where was Ezekiel at the time that Daniel lived? Well, a few years after Daniel went to Babylon, Ezekiel went to Babylon under a different set of conditions. Why is God destroying Jerusalem at this time? And how come it comes without any warning whatsoever and it's unannounced? Or did I just tell you a fat lie? It was announced for a long, long time ahead of time. And why? Why did God decide he had to take the extreme measure of killing a million people or so and deporting thousands off to Babylon and leaving them there for 70 years? Because they were worshiping other gods. They were real flaky about the one true God who had told them specifically how they should be living together with him. Oh, we've got a microphone here. Go.
The first microphone. I was wondering why that microphone was in there.
Okay.
No, actually, God told, I'm pretty sure it was Ezekiel, that if he could find one honest man, a single honest man anywhere in Jerusalem, he'd spare the whole city and couldn't find him.
Yes. That was the sort of conditions. Ezekiel got a little trip to Jerusalem in a vision, and he got to see the idolatry in the temple. Every man in his room of pictures worshiping idols. That's a polite word for pornography, I think, and being on the internet.
And they had also become more wicked than the nations that were about to...
The moral behavior of God's people was below that of the pagans around about them.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, if you really want to expound on it, what you do is you read 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles, yeah. And that will detail exactly why...
Homework assignment. Read Kings and Chronicles to get the historical background of the kings, the various kings, the division of Israel. At this time in history, what's happened in the nation of Israel? And maybe you can pick some approximate dates. And where was Isaiah at the time that Daniel came along?
He was the prophet of about five kings of Hezekiah. It was like five kings or four kings in a row when you read Isaiah.
Okay. Yeah. What about Israel? Israel is now divided into two nations, the 10 northern tribes, the 2 southern tribes. What's happened to the 10 northern nations by this time?
Captivity.
722. If you just write that little date down.
Dispersion.
Captivity. Oh, one word. Okay. And the captivity came by some marauding Egyptians. Is that how it happened? No. Assyria. And the Assyrians were kind and loving, and they brought along Red Cross trucks and mercy supplies. No, they didn't. The Assyrians were cruel and harsh, and they put hooks in the jaws of their captives and dragged them cruelly. We saw in Amos that they had a habit of laying people on the ground and driving sledges over them, the threshing sledges, just to chew them up into pieces. And they hauled all the people, almost all the people out of the 10 northern tribes and dispersed them off to the east, from which we get the term the 10 northern tribes of Israel. Actually, there were representatives of all 10 northern tribes that stayed in Jerusalem. So there never was a time when Israel wasn't represented by all these tribes. So the 10 northern tribes are gone. Was there any threat or danger to Jerusalem during this time? Yes? Yes, I think we've got a good answer here. And the end. That's right. The Assyrian army came right down to Jerusalem, and they had plundered even out to the coast at Lachish and came to the gates of Jerusalem, and they told Hezekiah they were going to knock the place down, and Hezekiah said, no, you're not. And he and Isaiah took the letter from the Assyrian general and laid it out on the floor of the temple and prayed over it and asked God to please spare Jerusalem. Though Jerusalem had every right to be destroyed, it could well have been destroyed, but they prayed over this piece of paper and God said, okay, I hear you. And then something incredible happened the following night to the Assyrian army.
They all got killed.
They all got killed, 173. And when they woke up in the morning, behold, they were all dead men. I think that's how the King James reads that. But they were killed in an overnight plague. And then was it Sennacherib that went off to his house a little dejected, and his sons came in and murdered him in a short while later. So this is the Bible. It's kind of a little bloody and violent, but that's because we're a fallen race and we don't always live right. Now, let's get back in the book of Daniel. Daniel now, immediate history is that Egypt was a great and mighty power in the world at this time. And the Egyptians and the Assyrians got into a big battle at Carchemish north of Israel. And as an incidental side of that, this battle didn't involve anybody except Egyptians and Assyrians, but Israel made a mistake at that time, which was very costly. Oh, I think we have we're going to have all winners here.
Israel's seeking to align itself with Egypt as
yes.
an ally.
And there's something else happened that was very tragic for Israel at that time. King?
You had Josiah on the throne.
King Josiah, boy.
A really godly guy.
Godly guy.
He led a revival, but for some reason, he had this wild idea that he had to go out and try to fight the Assyrian, or whoever that was, the Assyrians. And so the king of, actually, it wasn't the Assyrians, it was Egypt. And that was, trying to think of the name of the pharaoh right now, I can't remember, but... he said to Josiah, he says, look, I'm not here to fight you. I'm here to fight the Syrians, and God himself has sent me, and he's told me to hurry. So, you know, it's just stay out, you know. But Josiah kept on coming, and so he died in battle.
It's a very sad, and it's very costly for Israel, because here's a king, one of the few good kings who's zealous, and he had no business involving himself in this battle between two powers. Egypt and Assyria are fighting each other. King Josiah gets killed. As a side note, who comes up ascended in that? Who wins? The Assyrians win, and the Egyptians begin to slip down in power. So Assyria rises as the nation that has the charge of the whole region. And the Assyrians stay in power long enough to take away the 10 northern tribes, and then what happens? King Hezekiah is pretty self-confident, comes on the throne in the southern tribes, and he wants to make friends with some nice people down south of the Assyrians and have them come and see him and visit him, and the Babylonians. And the Babylonians come down, and Hezekiah says, come and see all my treasures and see the house of the Lord, see the temple and the gold and the silver, and just look at how wealthy I am and how God has given me all this wealth. And the Babylonians said, it's nice to meet you, sir. We've had a pleasure visiting. We'll establish some friendly relationships between you and us now. And they went back home, and the next important target on their ascendancy to world power is going to be Jerusalem. Okay, so this is all God's allowing it to his people, allowing this to happen to Israel, but there's a lot going on in the nations around there, and Israel's just a tiny little insignificant nation in comparison, but they do have a lot of gold in their temple. Well, we better get in the text here. Year 604 approximately is the year that Nebuchadnezzar comes to Jerusalem, and he's on his way home from this battle. In which he has defeated Nebuchadnezzar's got to get important. He's just a boy. His father is the king of Babylon. He finds out that while he was out on his campaign, his dad died, and he came home, and he's going to be the king. And he won the military victory at 605. And so he's now going to expand his empire and conquer the Assyrians and put together a great nation called Babylon. Okay? You remember all that? Oh, so he stops by Jerusalem, and he decides to start taking charge of Jerusalem. That's it. At that point on, he says, hey, you don't know it, but I've taken over here. And the Egyptians had come in and replaced one of the kings already. And in comes Jehoiakim as the king, and he doesn't know which way is up as far as religion and politics and God and so on. So he just waffles and goes, can't make any other choice. But Nebuchadnezzar does a very shrewd thing. He goes into Jerusalem, into the temple, and into the homes of the nobles, and he handpicks maybe 100 young men. Doesn't say whether he picked any young women. He might have. Doesn't say whether these guys are single or all married. Doesn't say that. Could be. But let's say there's 100 of them, and we learn about 4 of them here in this particular book. And these people are not taken into captivity as Ezekiel and his company were about the same time, a little later. And so what's the move? What's Nebuchadnezzar doing here? He's a new king. He's expanding his empire. And so he goes out to Jerusalem and he handpicks the brightest, the Stanford students. I don't know whether that's the brightest anymore, but at least some of these young men were godly. At least we know Daniel was, and probably they were observant Jews, and they may well have seen the handwriting on the wall back home in Jerusalem and started paying attention to God. Now, what's Nebuchadnezzar's strategy? I'm going to train these guys.
The whole thing is almost Machiavellian in that you take the best and you incorporate them so they can go back at some point in time to run their own country, but you're still in control. So yeah. It's actually a smart move.
Very smart move. And so eventually he's going to turn the running of Jerusalem back to these trained young men who've now been brainwashed in the ways of Babylon, particularly brainwashed in the Babylonian religion. So let's go and see if we can see some of these things in here. The third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, a bad king, came to Jerusalem and besieged it, took it over, took charge of the whole place. And he goes into the temple and he takes some of the sacred vessels. And he takes some of the sacred vessels from the temple, takes them to his temple in Babylon, and installs them in the temple of his gods. It wasn't just greed that motivated that. What does that symbolize? What do all the people think right now when they see this? All these what are these treasures, by the way? Well, they're pots and pans and shovels and things that you'd use in the temple in sacrificing animals, burning incense, all the things, and they're all made out of gold and silver and precious stones. They've been taken away several times. At the present time, the Jews in Jerusalem who are building the third temple, about to build it as soon as they can, have a collection of all the sacred vessels again. So they can, when they get a temple, they'll be able to move the sacred vessels or copies into their third new temple and start animal sacrifices, and then everybody will know that the Jews are the greatest in the world, religiously speaking. In the ancient world, nations had gods over them. Cities had gods over them. If you take the treasures out of the palace, out of the temple of a god here, and move that treasure over to another nation, another temple, you're saying, my God is stronger than your God. That God of Israel is nobody. So the real God is the Babylonian God, and Nebuchadnezzar is the right to be the ruler of all nations. He's got the most powerful God. Yes?
Without getting ahead too much, that statement really sheds light on how God deals with Nebuchadnezzar later in his life.
Yes, indeed. We get Nebuchadnezzar is a very, very interesting man. When you take on the God of Israel, it can be quite a ride. Over here we have Dr. Aniker.
Do I recall correctly that in addition to making that demonstration of, you know, my God's greater than the civilization I just took over, that also there was the notion that whatever power that God of that captivated nation had has been added to the victors?
That's right. Yeah. Babylon has now increased her spiritual power by virtue of having the favor of the God of Israel, which we know the God of Israel does not compromise. By the way, we're talking about Babylon here. If you were to read from Genesis onward, you'd find two important periods in the history of Babylon. Important period number one, an eclipse. Important period number two. Could somebody help out just for background on that? Because Babylon is very important where? And then it disappears, and now it's back.
Wasn't the first one the Tower of Babel?
Yeah. And?
No.
Not long after Noah comes off of the ark, the guy named Nimrod builds Babylon and sets up this mystery religion that's the center of all false religion in the world to this very day. And that Babylon, we notice Abraham entangled with them and got involved with them a while. And then a long period of silence in the Bible, and then now we get Babylon revived. So we're talking about Babylon revived with Nebuchadnezzar, and the lifetime of this nation is only about 70 or 80 years, because God has a purpose for Babylon, and when it's done, he lets Babylon be run over. Yeah.
But I don't know if this is Babylon number two or Babylon number three, but...
Yeah. Oh, yeah, good.
You've got Babylon coming up. Basically stands for world religion, really.
Yes, it does. And not only that, but Babylon is it turns out to be quite an intellectual center of power and learning. The astrology, astronomy, from whence Daniel helped started the system of the Magi, which persists on down. And so Daniel is a man that's going to take advantage of his position and evangelize and lead people to the Lord and start study centers and as much as he can within his limits. And the Babylonians are really good at agriculture. They're right in between the Tigris and Euphrates River, so they know how to use the land wisely. They have architecture, big, marvelous buildings. They specialize in law and mathematics, in business administration, in government, in religion. Preston, I think, could tell us about that great university there, probably the great University of Babylon. And so this is a seat of knowledge and power, and it's religion all mixed in, which is why when it turns evil, you get mystery Babylon the Great in Revelation. A false religion, but also a false world system. Commerce and trade and banking. We got all this problem in Wall Street right now and all the problem in banking and finance. Where do you suppose it all came from? The corrupt side thing. Babylon. Okay. Now, the king has given these young men, and we're going to learn about four of them here, that have a nice living quarters in the palace. Ezekiel's outside of town in a campground of old military Quonset huts, and they're separate, but they're serving the same God. And Daniel gets settled in, and over him is Ashkenaz, the master of the eunuchs, to bring some of the children of Israel and some of the king's descendants and some of the nobles. So this is, they get put under the drill sergeant Ashpenaz, and he's the chief of the eunuchs. Now there's a confusion here. The Hebrew word can mean castrated males. Doesn't have to mean it, but it could. It doesn't have to, but it's not unusual in the ancient world for a king to castrate the young men he puts in charge of his harem, for example, the men that he wants to keep loyal. And Daniel and his friends are teenagers, so We don't really know. We'll have to find out. They may have stayed single all their lives. They may have had wives. We don't know. We have to talk to them. The main thing is that they put up with a huge disruption in their lives. They're being pulled away from mother and dad and school buddies, and they don't have their iPhones anymore, and they haven't got their favorite programs on TV, and they're thrust all alone, cut off from all their roots, and then their hopes of serving in the government of Israel are all gone. So they're remarkable young men right from the start. The king is instructed that these young men have their names changed. Why would you do that? Just change their names. Is that important?
The names they have originally, Daniel, Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael, are Hebrew names with the name of the Hebrew God in them, Daniel, which means God has judged. Each one of them has a special meaning.
Yep.
And so the Babylonians want to rename them to be reflective of their God and not the God of Israel.
Good. I liked what Ray Stedman said about this. A series of small steps and one becomes like his God. A series of small steps and one becomes like his God. And that's the king is hoping. Give them a nice Babylonian name. We'll get them used to our culture, our way of life. They'll settle in and be perfectly good Babylonians.
Bert, if you've seen the movie Roots, which I have.
Roots?
Roots. About the first African-Americans who came here. They changed their names also.
Did they?
And they did that to extinguish their past and give them a new self-identity.
Oh, that's very interesting. It's good. In this country, we have a great profusion of Christian names, biblical names, or Jewish names. We have people who come up from the Latin American world generally have biblical names changed into Spanish, say, for example. So, over here.
And God has a new name for each one of us.
That's good. Hey, I like that. There is a new name for every one of us as Christians that tells of our new identity. If anyone is in Christ, he is a new creation. Old things have passed away. Behold, all things have become new.
I was going to say, is the other day, you look at the Old Testament, when God names something, that establishes ownership. So when he names Abraham, Jacob, Israel, they say, I'm establishing relationship.
Yeah. Now, these guys are willing to have their names changed, but that does not affect their hearts and their identities and their loyalty to Jesus. But they're in a prison camp, essentially, and as long as they're polite and as long as they don't compromise on the root important issues with God, they'll be fine. They have to stay separated, what we call separated, by in their heart of hearts living differently than the pagans around them do. And this is tricky because we find out what the Nebuchadnezzar wants right here pretty much. Verse 4, they are young men, so they're young and good looking and they no zits, I guess, and so on. No blemish, good looking, gifted in all wisdom. So these are the really smart kids. Possessing knowledge, real high on the SAT. They were willing to serve. They would be obedient, just like somebody to say serving in Congress or serving in an important business corporation where the president needs good, sound, reliable help. The king appointed for them a daily provision of delicacies. So the king, now if you come into the palace of the king, you get the absolute best food, according to their local chefs and the TV program on cooking that Julia Child ran for them for a while. And they had a 3-year program to get it retrained. We see their names changed in verses 6 and 7. Now, verse 8 is clue. Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's delicacies, nor with wine which he drank. Therefore, he requested of the chief of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. Now, what is this defiling yourself by the food you eat? Are we under any such prohibition?
No.
No. This is something that applied to Israel, to the Jews, the dietary laws in the book of Moses? What were they about? What were they there for? They're not in effect now. What were they there for with regard to Israel?
To keep them from being diseased and
Yeah, say that again.
Just to keep them a pure race so they wouldn't have disease, etc.
That's right. There's a wonderful old book, and None of These Diseases, written by a medical doctor who analyzed these dietary laws and the Jews in the wilderness and how these were wise things to do to stay safe when the water is bad, and what kind of foods would be healthy and what would not, but also to teach about God. What things does God approve of? What things are base and demeaning and inappropriate for God's people?
Yeah, some scholars say the purpose of those dietary laws was to just keep them as a separate race, so that throughout history God would always have the Jews around. Like, there's places in the world where, you know, if all you can eat from meat is shellfish, you can't be a Jew.
Yeah. Israel is a mixed bag because there are observant and non-observant Jews to this day. Generally, the food restrictions go under the title kosher, and some Jews keep kosher and others don't. It's not a big deal in the New Testament. So Daniel is going to observe the limitations that the law of Moses puts on them to follow voluntarily, that they could please God.
Why would God have relaxed his dietary restrictions and allowed us to participate in all that corruption?
Well, I did. Yes, repeat it, yeah. He captured the sound and then he ran off with it.
Why would God have relaxed his dietary restrictions and allowed us to participate in all that corruption?
Very good. Good question. How come God has contradicting himself by holding us to different standards arbitrarily? Oh.
Well, one reason might be so that the gospel could spread all the way around the world.
Oh, that's good.
This is where it's very difficult to have those dietary restrictions.
Yeah, you can't be kosher in every nation you visit if you're a missionary.
I think the only wild animal to eat on the Hawaiian Islands is pork.
Yeah, that's true. So we don't need the teaching illustration, but what about health foods? What about eating right? What about vitamins? What about turn on the TV and you get Dr. So-and-so, and you get an email from Dr. So-and-so telling you that you're eating all the bad things, and you probably are, and the food processors dumb everything down as far as quality, and you probably shouldn't eat today's junk food. What about that?
Well, I'm not sure I can answer that. I was thinking of something else. I think on Royce's question, and I think maybe Bob mentioned, that the nation is called to be a separate and holy people. And this was the way that the Lord did that in that time.
Yeah.
The New Testament makes it clear that what, you know, Jesus said, it isn't what you put into your stomach, it's what comes out of your heart. And so I think that the dietary restrictions are a picture of being
good,
a people for God's own possession. And we're called now to live in a way that is separate from the world, but still in it. So there's just a number of places that say it really doesn't matter as much, but there still is the appeal of conscience. And there is also the fact that we're to be stewards even of our own bodies, and maybe to your question, loading up on the worst stuff out there isn't the best idea, because then we can't be of service to the Lord.
John?
The pivotal event in the New Testament regarding the change is the conversion of Cornelius.
Mm-hmm.
And God directly intervened. The start of the story of Cornelius is God's direct intervention that clearly signals, hey, I'm going out to the whole world, not just my chosen people anymore. And Cornelius doesn't really know what's going on. It's just that he had come to fear God. And Peter is God's transition person from that point of view. And Peter's not going to eat anything unclean. And God says, don't call anything unclean that I've declared clean.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a clear switching from only being focused on the nation of Israel to going out to the world. And then, of course, we read Paul, and Peter's move gets exponential growth.
Today, if you were to visit the corporate offices of one of the Silicon Valley companies and the president had you over for lunch, what would you expect? He would probably wine you and dine you with the most expensive imports. And by the time you got out 3 hours after lunch started, you'd stagger out to your car and drive home and crash. That's the kind of the lifestyles of the rich and famous, isn't it? It's overindulgence and living high on the hog because you earned it, because you're important. So, but we don't have to do that. We'll just take a couple of sandwiches and Oddwalla and have a quiet lunch in the patio. That's all. The idea would be to be ready to represent God by your lifestyle, by the way you live. So Daniel is not going to defile himself with the portions of the king's delicacies. You don't need delicacies for a good balanced diet, hummingbirds' tongues and whatever they have now. So but he has to get permission. If they're going to serve him food, Daniel has got to get permission, and he goes to the chief of the eunuchs and says, hey, can we get the diet modified? And this chief of the eunuchs says, uh-oh, you guys really shouldn't do this, because I'll get in trouble with Nebuchadnezzar when you guys don't turn out healthy at the end of this training program, and I'll lose my job. The king has a habit of chopping off heads when he doesn't like somebody, and he can have his temper is kind of bad. So the chief of the eunuchs. So Daniel now is going to interact with those who are over him, with authority over him, in this situation that he didn't ask for. So Daniel said, hey, give us a trial. We're going to be in your program for 3 years. Give us 10 days of the food that we select. And he would probably have chosen pretty modest food. Give us some bread, give us some fish, give us some fresh fruits, give us some vegetables, and it would be a modest meal. And they kept the modest meal for 10 days, and at the end of the time, Daniel and his friends looked healthier. They were radiant. The food they had didn't have a bunch of additives in it, and it wasn't genetically modified, and you didn't have to read the label. It was all just good, healthy food, okay? So they passed that test. What's the general rule if you are a Christian and you've got your lifestyle, what you like and don't like, what you like to wear, eat, how you like to live your life, and you are a servant, a company has bought your services, or you're a prisoner of war and you work for somebody like this, and they say, oh, we have a different set of standards here that you have to conform to, what would you do? How would you handle that and not compromise your Christian belief? Or would it be okay to compromise your Christian belief? If so, how? This is a real situation for us Christians in a pagan part of the world today. And we've already really answered it. Are you the distinctive people of God? Do you stand out as somebody different? Do you have joy? Do you have a sense of happiness? How do you feel? What's your demeanor? If you've had a time with the Lord this morning, you're probably pretty up and pretty radiant and pretty enthused, and you're going to go work for these pagans who are dejected, have had bad hangovers. They're angry and irritable and grouchy, and they may be a little touchy about the rules they put in place, and you've been breaking them. Are there some rules that you disagree with? Yes. You refuse. And Daniel, they refuse the dietary modification. How do we handle this? I don't know that we get much teaching about it these days anymore. Cynthia's.
What I like about what he did was he did it respectfully.
Yeah.
And he just said, you know, let us show you. Let's try it for 10 days, and if it doesn't work, then we'll cooperate. You know, can we try this option? He did it with respect.
Daniel has concerns for the future and career of his boss. He takes an interest in this man. He'd like the man to become a believer, so he's going to be loving and sensitive. And, oh, gosh, I don't want you to lose your job. Let's work on this. So right away, there's not a hostile working relationship at all. It's congenial. Okay? So at the end of 10 periods, Daniel gets mostly vegetables, it seems like, verse 16. Look at verse 17 and see what's happening besides the training program. As for these four young men, God gave them knowledge and skill in all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in dreams and visions. God gave these men gifts and skills and aptitudes in areas of specialty they knew nothing about until they came to Babylon. Now they've got to learn the language and the customs and the religion and the economics and the history, just as if they were Babylonians, just as if they were natives. And God now is teaching. God's their teacher. Isn't that really amazing? If you go to a strange land, a foreign country, a foreign people, and you ask God for help and insight, God is happy to teach you. You're not going to buy into their philosophies, but you're going to understand them. That makes sense? What happens to missionaries when they go off into the jungle someplace and meet the Walla Walla tribe or whatever it is, Boogla Boogla tribe, that knows no English and has different customs? What do? You find the common ground and you get to know them and you find out what their... Yeah.
We happened to have last night for dinner an old friend of Lori's who's a missionary in Bolivia. Thanks. Mm-hmm. And he was explaining that how in the, what did he say? He didn't want to use the word primitive. He said unspoiled cultures. Mm-hmm. There is what they call this redemptive bridge. And I think he said one example was the book written by the guy that wrote about the peace child. There is some link in the culture which takes some observation and entering into. And he told me this fascinating story about a guy named Bruce Olson who ended up in first Venezuela and then Colombia. And apparently all the stories of the native tribes there had some tall, blonde person showing up with information about the true God. And so it was just fascinating how there is this connection in other cultures, but you have to sort of be willing to enter in and learn about it and try to figure out what those connections are.
Yeah, that's really good. That's excellent. And at the same time, in the process, there would be certain practices common in that tribe that we would shun. Maybe they smoke peyote, for example, to get a religious experience, and you could decline that. And on the grounds that your religious system didn't allow that, say. Now, at the end of 3 years, the king has a graduation class for these four men. I don't think it's just the four men now. I think he's getting all of his students, and he's going to take these foreign kids and quiz them on everything. Verse 18, at the end of the days when the king had said that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. The king interviewed, the idea in the original language is talked with them. He had informal, get to know them rather than a formal written quiz. So he's astute and piercing insights, and he wants to figure out what they're really like, not the game they're playing. He interviewed them, and among them was none like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore, they served before the king. You guys graduated. I want you in my palace. I'm not going to send you out in the provinces. I want you right here because you are the best in all matters of wisdom and understanding about which the king examined them. He found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers who were in his realm. And Daniel continued until the first year of King Cyrus, which is about 70 years later. 10 times, 10 hands better. Now, these guys are by now maybe 18 years old, something like that, 19, at the end of 3 years. And they went to school with a whole bunch of bright, gifted, sharp Babylonians and maybe some people from other countries. And it's not cool as a foreigner to come into a land of pride and sophistication and learn their system and learn it better than they know it. And they grew up there. And that's going to make these guys very unpopular with their fellow students, many of whom are quite a bit older and quite a bit more seasoned. And why are they serving the king? Because they're the best in the land. What about that? Wasn't that maybe a bad thing? Shouldn't have Nebuchadnezzar gone and got the old sages from Jerusalem instead of the boys? Shouldn't he have gotten the real seasoned, experienced professors from the University of Jerusalem, say? Was it a good move for him to pick these kids that are not dry behind the ears yet and they haven't been through their teenage wildness yet?
Very smart.
Very smart, yes it was.
Well, they can, if you're a kid, you're not set in your ways.
Yes.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
And so that's one of the biggest reasons.
Yes, you can absorb all this knowledge and not necessarily totally adapt it. And and you're adaptable, good-natured, rebound, teachable, friendly. They're going to make friends with the Babylonians now. These guys know enough about their God to know that he's a God of love and understanding, that that God wants to use them, and they're going to get that right away. They're going to make friends with their captors. 10 times better. What do you think? Is there a situation like that that goes on in this country today?
Yes.
Yes, there is.
There is.
What happens? Saudi Arabia has sent some of their bright, gifted students over here. Japan sends over people that they think will be good in their government in a few years. Tibet sends over somebody special in Indonesia, and they come into our universities and
they excel.
And they really, so what is the Institute of Technology in Bombay in India that is absolutely the best university in the whole wide world? Kids start signing up for it when they're 7, 8 years old and training in hopes they can get in. And those graduates come over here and they're already CEO material. They don't need any of our graduate stuff. And how does that make us look? Fat and lazy and decadent and out of touch. Isn't that the likely thing in a nation that takes itself for granted, takes God for granted, is that we're just going to be fat and lazy and find out that we've been taken over?
Right.
Taken over by people of another culture, another set of religious values, and they're very bright, so they can win themselves up to the top in leadership? Yep. Okay. Now, let's have a few closing comments on chapter. Let's have some more insights.
Well, especially since Helen is now in university, but it strikes me that this is a model for young people going off to college, that they can enter into what's being taught there, but with an understanding that God is the source of all wisdom and knowledge, and that they, in some sense, keep themselves separate, not necessarily on dorm food, but more about, their worldview and how they think, where does knowledge come from? And just the presuppositions they bring into their studies lets them enter into university life completely and still remain true to the Lord. So you can study the philosophers or whatever with an understanding of where true truth comes from.
Good. Now, they're going to get news. After they've been over there quite a while, they're going to get the news that Jerusalem has been destroyed, and that most of the people are dead, and they're never going to go back there again. Now what, you can't write mommy and daddy, you can't plan to, when you get out of prison, to take a camel tour of Israel, because it's not there anymore. And so all your friends are dead and gone, your parents are dead and gone, or they're scattered. And now there's just, say, the four of you here.
You're a good teacher because you're making me think.
Well, thank you. That's a sign of a great teacher.
Well, you're very kind.
If, you know, in that situation where you could tell the difference in the continence of the four within 10 days,
mm-hmm.
that tells me that the diet of the others was probably so bad.
It probably was.
And I'm thinking that Nebuchadnezzar's attitude, because I've read the book, is influenced by the testimony of these people in that he was vexed when they had to go into the furnace.
Yeah.
He was vexed when Daniel had to go into the lion's den because they were such a fantastic display of their health and their attitude. And he let them get away with a lot without beheading them. And so what's going on here is how God wins pagans over by our testimony.
And the believers work together. This is not four independent Lone Ranger believers. They're a body. They're part of the body of Christ. So they can have, when they go back to their quarters at night, they can have prayer meeting. They can have Daniel open up the Bible. They can share the matters of what happened today and pray for each other. So they've got that. So this is a real threat to the Babylonian Empire. And Babylon doesn't realize they've been invaded, really. And God's going to turn this around to be the end of Babylon. And eventually, turning around the whole world to the Lord Jesus. I think that with God being the same God that Daniel serves, and human nature being as bad as it ever was and depraved, we have to constantly look at our relationship with each other, with the non-Christian world, the times in which we live. And we have to say, I belong to Jesus. I can't live this way anymore, my old lifestyle. I've got to be knowledgeable of the Bible, at least. That should come first before my secular studies in the university. Nowadays, I just wonder, is there really any value to going to get a college education if the faculty has all been dumbed down and demoralized and you can't get a job if you go study some particular specialty in school right now. Wouldn't you be better to just know the Bible really, really well and find some Christians and start from some ground level? Yeah, probably. Preston, what do you think of the university system in the world and in this country and in 25 words?
Well, there is a ray of hope up in Canada, a place called Trinity Western,
mm-hmm.
where the president came back and he had all along been in favor of integrating all the disciplines with biblical Christian worldview. And he came back and found that it had been sort of set aside. He came back to resurrect that. Now, this is a Christian university, so it's unique. But a Christian university that isn't populated by professors who went to secular universities and got, overly influenced.
Mm-hmm.
And we spoke with one of these gals down at that conference at Dallas Willard, and she said it was so exciting to be encouraged in her department to do her research with that kind of emphasis. And she so sorely missed it when she had to transfer down to Western Washington University because of her marriage to somebody. And so, that's kind of rare, unfortunately.
Small Christian schools generally depend on the contributions from their alumni or from people in the community who've got money to spend. But generally, there's power behind that money that says, we don't want you teaching this and such, and we'll give you $100,000 if you'll drop that part of your curriculum.
Right.
And so that's kind of bribery. And
it's gotten so bad. I think it's like people who've forgotten God have got to the point where instead of believing nothing, they'll believe anything. Yeah. And so you have all these competing gods, so-called, in these universities.
Yeah, that's good, yeah. Competing gods. That's the relativistic morals of today are, it doesn't matter what you believe, and everything's all relative anyhow. And so if you want to have your beliefs, that's fine. See that? Well, we will stop at chapter 1. You may read ahead. On my website, ldolphin.org/Daniel, lowercase, is a whole bunch of notes that I put up when I was smarter than I am now, before my brain started to go. And I think you'll find those notes from Ray and others would be helpful to you. So please take Daniel seriously as if you've never read it before. And we'll have a hymn.
Hymn number 8. There are hymns that far back in the book.
Eight.
It's actually from Daniel. Mm-hmm.
How do you teach with this reflection?
Praise to the Lord, the Almighty, the King of creation. Oh, my soul, praise Him, for He is thy health and salvation. All ye who hear, now to His temple draw near. Join me in glad adoration. Praise to the Lord, who o'er all things so wondrously
chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession, so that you may proclaim the excellencies of Him who has called you out of the darkness into His marvelous light. For once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. You had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. Beloved, I urge you as aliens and strangers to abstain from fleshly lusts which wage war against the soul. Keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that in the thing in which they slander you as evildoers, they may, because of your good deeds, as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation. Father, that's our prayer, that we would be a holy people, and that your power and your love and your mercy would be evident in our lives. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.